Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. There is something in the oxygen of Providence, Rhode Island. No one knows what it is, but it was a certain chemistry, an ether, a theory from long ago and far away. The patron saint of all that economics was one William Poole, who ended up with wonderful public service at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis years ago. David, why don't you bring our two guests in, other than to say that this is a special Brown University moment. We say that to all of Brown economics and Brown scholarship.
That's probably a school song to be sung, but we'll save that for later in the hour. Bob Cinch with us, global strategist at Amherst Pierpont and Hiroshi Watanabe, the president of the Institute for International Monetary Affairs, joining us as well. You two were office mates in Providence. So tell us a bit about sort of what you were doing at Brown. Let me move these mics a little bit as well. Sorry. So I take care of some housekeeping as well. You met each other. Give us a sense of what brought you guys together.
Well, you know, they it was a relatively small class.
Yeah,
I think only about 20 of us in the program, and Hiroshi and I and a third guy shared an office together. Office hours with the undergrads. We did have a special time between 2 and 2:30 afternoon when we did not have office hours because, believe it or not, the Gong Show was on and all the graduate students in economics would go into one office and unfortunately watch the Gong Show for 30 minutes while undergrads cooled their heels out in the hallway.
Hiroshi, you have gone on to great acclaim within Japanese economics. And part of what I think of Brown University is the underlying theories involved now. What is the underlying theory right now of Bank of Japan and Ministry of Finance economics? Away from the simplicity of Abenomics, what's the underlying theory?
Well, sometimes we call the current government's policy the three arrows operation to that. So the first one is the monetary the policy change, and the second one is the fiscal policy stimulus, and the third one is the structural reform, including some of the growth strategy to that. So but the original meaning of the three arrows, it should be done in simultaneously. But the current government is a little bit squeezed on the situation, and it should be shot one by one to that. And very frankly speaking, in the first one, the monetary change has been working so hard and so drastic to that. And the second one is a little bit working in addition to such kind of the monetary policy change to that. So the government is now a little bit lazy to perform the third arrows of the structural reform to that. But now the government realized the first one in the monetary change is just giving the time allowances, not the fundamental change would be given by the monetary changes. So I think now the government started to work on the third arrows, especially starting the end of the 15. They can work on that.
If you're just joining us now, Hiroshi Watanabe with us. He is with the Japan Bank for International Cooperation, the governor and chief executive officer. And Robert Cinch with us is Amherst Pierpont. They're going to be with us through the hour. We will speak with Bob Cinch about sterling and the momentous moves in foreign exchange. We'll do that later in the next half hour. David?
Yeah, Bob, let me just ask you about what Hiroshi was saying there a little bit, that they're a little bit squeezed right now. What are you seeing as you look at Japan from your perch here in the U.S.?
You know, I think what's happening in Japan is not dissimilar to what's happening in the rest of the developed world, right? There has been an excessive reliance on monetary policy to drive the economic expansion. We're now getting into that expansion mode. And the real questions now are, you know, can we implement structural reform? Japan, I think it's a big issue. Europe, it's also a very big issue. And these are really structural reforms that are needed to generate faster potential growth. as the working age populations are shrinking in many of these countries. And we're not seeing big productivity gains. And so the result is you have potential GDP growth that in the Eurozone is maybe 1 to 1.5%, in Japan maybe 0.5% to 1%, in the U.S. maybe somewhere around 2%. And you really need to get much faster potential growth to generate the kind of momentum in the global economy that everybody would like to see. And now it becomes incumbent upon fiscal policy, regulatory policy, and structural reforms. And as we know, those are very difficult. And surprisingly, we think about the political morass here in the U.S. and the inability to get policy really moving forward. You would think it would be easier in Japan, where the LDP has pretty good control over policy.
Let's come back. Bob Cinch with us, with Hiroshi Watanabe as well. Both of Brown University. This is Bloomberg. This is a real treat. We're going to digress here. We're going to get to Bob Cinch in a bit here on the huge moves, his brilliant call on sterling strength. We'll do that in a bit. Hiroshi Watanabe with us, who was a classmate of Bob Cinch's at Brown University. And what this means, we're going to go a little wonkdom here. 1978, Money in the Economy, Bill Poole. That was the Bible, the gospel. There were a few other papers. Bob Cinch, translate for our audience the effect and the power of a monetarist theory in the late 70s. It was gospel, wasn't it?
You know, the 70s was a very interesting time because, there was some view that the business cycle had been conquered. And we found out later that a lot of that was the result of very stimulative fiscal policy and accommodative monetary policy in the late 60s into the early 70s, which, of course, manifests itself into a rapid acceleration of inflation pressures, higher energy prices. We know the history. And, you know, monetarism really was not very widely followed and certainly practiced amongst government economists. It was very much a Keynesian world. And what Bill Poole did was really introduce monetary analysis to a broad array of students, certainly, and something that I gravitated toward and found very, very useful in terms of analyzing inflation pressures as we went through the 70s and then the whole disinflation process of the 1980s that was really ushered in by a much tighter monetary policy. So I think the 70s and the 80s was really the peak period for monetary analysis and useful not only in policy but also in markets.
Okay, well, then Hiroshi Watanabe, help me here with the names Carl Bruner, Alan Meltzer, Anna Schwartz, maybe David Laidler of Western Ontario as well. The world used to stop when young Cinch and I, Cinch was still wearing goalie pads in the job then. But help me here with the world stopped on Thursdays for M1, M2, M3. It was gospel. What happened? What did you learn about the end of our worship of M1, M2, M3?
Yeah, we discussed M1, M2, M3. These days we have another M. So many big varieties to that. And also the Bob says in the 70s, 80s, that period is very much the... and suitable to such kind of discussion to that. But the last 25 years, always now we see the abundance of the money. That's quite different from the age of the 70s, 80s. So since the early 90s, almost every year, the interest rate is going down and down and down. There is no sign of the pickup to that. So that caused too much big the change, or even such kind of theory and or such kind of analysis to that.
How have you seen the study of monetary policy evolve, Bob? Where does the monetary policy you learned at Brown, the Brown School, continue today?
You know, I think there's one issue that started in the 70s and 80s in terms of financial innovation and what impact that had on analyzing monetary policy. But I think really what's happened is a realization of how important the banking system is to monetary analysis. And, you know, monetary analysis and monetarism and its impact on nominal GDP and inflation works under the assumption of a steady money multiplier, so the ratio of money supply in the system to the monetary base, and also stable velocity of money, so the relationship of nominal GDP to monetary growth. And what we've seen is as banking systems become dysfunctional, these monetary linkages begin to break down. And so, you know, we're accustomed to a period where, you know, monetary analysis mm-hmm. could give us results. We've now come to realize how important the banking sector is globally to turning monetary right. policy from central banks into economic outcomes.
Hiroshi Watanabe with us, governor and the chief executive officer of the Japan Bank for International Cooperation. We really begin today our international coverage as we go to the World Bank and IMF meetings Thursday and Friday. Francine will jet in tonight. She's on the surveillance golf stream, right, David? I think she's coming.
Going to pick her up, and she'll be here tomorrow, yeah. right? She's in New York tomorrow.
It's easier to get the Teeterboro than JFK. Anyways, Francine will be in tomorrow. Maybe she'll be able to stop by and be with me and David as well. Much to talk about on international economics, but we demand that Bob Sinch of Amherst Pierpont, here with Mr. Watanabe, his classmate at Brown, take a victory lap on sterling. You called the bottom on sterling. You went long, strong sterling. You were right. Did you ever imagine a 128 and a snap election?
You know, I didn't think we'd get up to these kind of levels. I thought around 125 would probably be it on sterling. Clearly, this is an aggressive move by the prime minister in terms of solidifying her leadership. And I think there are a lot of uncomfortable shorts in sterling. Yeah. I think they're, you know, complacent short positions in sterling right. that are really getting squeezed.
And to frame some of the houses on this, HSBC and Deutsche Bank with weak sterling calls, UBS and Kitschuk's over at SocGen with leveling to even a stronger sterling call. There's winners and losers on this. But Alan Ruskin with a wonderful note this morning as Deutsche Bank threw in the towel and looked for sterling stability and such. What are the legs here? If the shorts all cover, can that drive sterling to unimaginable recent levels like 135, as Alan alludes to, or even back to a Brexit 140-something?
You know, I don't think so. I think we've traced out over the last 4 or 5 months the range, which I think is 120 to 130. So you have calls for 110 that got frustrated on the downside. We may get calls for 135 and higher get frustrated on the upside. Actually, I think that in the midst of this big short covering, what we're facing is, I think, a UK economy that is in the process of slowing down. Last year, surprised that the initial Brexit decision had very little impact on the economy. I think it was actually stimulative for the economy, because consumers, seeing a big drop in the pound, expected higher prices in the future. When you expect higher prices in the future, you accelerate your consumption into the present. So I think the consumer did a lot of anticipatory buying in the second half of 2016. They've run out of that spending power. We're now seeing a slowdown of employment growth. We're now seeing prices actually moving higher, so real income growth has slumped to close to zero in the UK. So I think just as we're getting this big short covering rally, in fact, the economy is going to surprise a bit on the downside. I think Prime Minister May is lucky that is a very short time mm-hmm. between the announcement and the actual election, because I think the economy is in the process of slowing pretty significantly.
And David, in my reading, I've heard that theme. Mm. That there's a huge advantage here to June 8th.
Hiroshi Watanabe, let me pull back here and ask about currency more generally. We've had the President of the United States saying he's not going to declare China a currency manipulator. You've had Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, talking about the strength of the dollar. How does all of that rhetoric sound in Japan when you hear not just the Treasury Secretary, but the President jawboning about currency issues here in the U.S.?
Yeah, we are a little bit puzzled because the many voices from the president and also the secretary, so they have so much different on that. So they were going to know how exactly the U.S. is going to think about that. But maybe nobody knows, even in the United States, to that. So I think the current position of the Japanese yen and the dollar is not so much bad for the either country to that. So from now on, I think there's some political confusion in the Europe is going to make the euro weaker, and even the sterling pound is somewhat moving on. But I generally agree with what Bob said to that. So I think the European currency is going to be a little bit weaker. Mm. And the dollar and the yen would be a little bit stronger. But between the dollar and the yen, I don't think at this moment we don't have any big impact to move either way to that. Especially for the current the trade policy of the United States is going to make the dollar a little bit stronger. And also, that as far as the Madam Yellen is going to raise the interest rate coming again, in that case, the definitely in the basic position is going to have the stronger dollar. Even the president is going to make the weaker, the dollar would be fine to that. But I think the market doesn't work in that way to that. And also, the president has the weakened the attack to the China, because if they stop the China to make an intervention to the market, renminbi would be much, much weaker. That means more easy to sell the product to the United States. So now the president is realized what the reality is. That is very good situation at this moment to that. So,
Bob Cinch, as Tom said, he's headed to the IMF meetings later this week. We got the growth forecast, the new revised growth forecast yesterday. Christine Lagarde telling Francine Lockwell last week that spring is in the air for the global economy. What's your reaction to what the IMF had to say yesterday, sort of leaving U.S. growth projections at the same amount? There were a few changes therein, but what do you make of the sort of rosy assessment of the rosier assessment, I should say, of the global economy?
Well, I think it's a great look in the rearview mirror. The IMF late last year was still fairly downbeat on global growth, and I think the green shoots here for early 2017 were pretty clear at that time, and we've gotten a pretty nice acceleration. Hasn't showed up in the U.S. GDP numbers, but if you look around the rest of the world, I think we're heading towards real GDP growth of over 2% year over year in the Eurozone. We haven't seen that for a number of years. Japan has had, I think, 5 quarters of consecutive increases in growth. It's not spectacular, but that's not bad by recent standards. So I think we are going through a better growth pattern in the early part of this year, and in a sense, the IMF is just confirmation of that, because they move very, very slowly in their analysis and forecast.
Is this a calendar reset, in that it's just the time of year where the certitude of the end of the year, the certitude of January is the Fed will do this, the Fed will do that, the Bank of Japan will do this, et cetera, and you sort of get to sell in May and go away, and everything begins to get lengthened out. It's oops, we're not so certain, and there's just autumn.
Yeah, I think we're going through a little bit of that. I think that late last year, early this year, there were surprises to the upside in growth. You know, the economic surprise indexes that are calculated were all very, very strong readings. Now expectations have been brought higher. Going to be difficult to beat those expectations going forward. But I do think there is some sustained momentum. The question, I think, for markets is, will central banks around the world do anything about that? And I think we've gotten another indication from the Bank of Japan that they have no intention of restraining monetary policy anytime soon. There was a little, I think, very unfounded bubbling up of optimism that the ECB might hike rates this year, with a core inflation print that was just confirmed at 0.7%. I don't think there's a chance in the world the ECB tightens policy this year, which is why I think there's still upside for the dollar as we go through the year.
Hiroshi, please help us. And I think of Robert Feldman at Morgan Stanley and others that have given us wonderful perspective on your Japan. Is there a generational shift within Abenomics? You have students. You speak to the younger of Japan. Is there a generational shift going on in your Japan?
You know, currently we have some the internal struggle between generation to that. And also we are going to think about how the pension system is going to be sustained to that. So who would bear such kind of burden is a big concern we are going to have to that. But we have about the 1,600 trillion yen in the individual asset. Maybe 2,000 or more would be held by the aged people to that. So that could be transferred to the younger generation. Is that one idea to that? And so we are going to have the more reliance to the consumption tax instead of the individual income tax to that. That means that the smaller number of the laborers, generally for the younger generation, is going to have the less burden of tax payment. And also the age of people who is going to consume more is going to have the more tax burden. Such kind of the balance would be also discussed on that. So even though the taxation would be appreciated. But I think such kind of the trade-off would be one of the big concerns we're going to have to that.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Hiroshi Watanabe is Governor and Chief Executive Officer of the Japan Bank for International Cooperation. I made a joke earlier, 10 seconds. You're not predicting 140 sterling, right?
Absolutely.
Okay,
not.
I want to be sure.
Absolutely.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. Bob Cinch of Amherst Pierpont, thank you so much We say good morning to all of Brown University Economics. Worldwide, this is Bloomberg. He is out of First Boston long ago and far away. And then he co-founded something in 1988, and everybody's like, yeah, you know, okay, great, Blackstone, BlackRock, Black this. And Lawrence Fink has built a juggernaut at BlackRock. They announced earnings today, and of course, they're knee-deep in the asset management business and such. He speaks on politics as well. He's out of UCLA a bit ago in the Anderson School. Our Eric Schatzker sat down with Mr. Fink today, and of course, the conversation had to turn to the new United Kingdom.
I would say from our fears of the third and fourth quarter going into the first quarter, I would say the fears have abated somewhat. We still don't understand what Brexit will mean for the UK. I've been in constant dialogue with the May administration. They ask us, what are our intentions? And our intentions is to stay pat and watch. Until we understand what Brexit means related to Europe, and one of the key elements that people have not talked about, the Europeans have been discussing items like, we want you to manage all European liabilities in Europe. Now, most firms use London as its platform for that. If they can find a way to force that type of behavior change that you move, that you have to manage, so you have to have your traders, your portfolio managers in continental Europe, that is the key element, because if we have to move to Europe to manage it, then the banks will move their trading desks to Europe and the custodial, and everything can be, you know, it could be quite disarming. And difficult, but so until we know where that stands. Yep. Now, that's pretty anti-trade. That's a real severe issue, but that is a pivotal issue for financial institutions related to being in the City of London or outside. Beyond that, I mean, to me, Brexit is a wait-and-see issue. I think the Prime Minister is doing a very aggressive thing, but you know, the popularity of the party is very strong.
Yeah.
It valid if the polling is correct and there's an overwhelming win, it validates and solidifies herself as a PM and the party. And so I look at this as a more of a gesture of strength than anything else. But we have the French election this weekend. and I don't know. I mean, you know, we still have a strong view that it looks like Macron can eke it out, but every day is a different day, and we see, you know, an incredible horse race there. So the market today is anticipating, I would say, a probable good outcome.
Why is Macron a good outcome?
Well, I think they're more fearful of the two tails. I think a Fillon outcome would be perceived to be good too. So the marketplace is looking at a more centrist outcome, an outcome that that has the French government wishing to stay within the Eurozone, more pro-trade, and so we'll see. I mean, I think it would be a very difficult thing if we had one of the tails winning. And the markets would probably reverse and go down even further.
Larry, can we draw a contrast between Europe and the United States? There are risks. Of course there are risks. And then there's the question as to whether the risks are appropriately reflected in asset values. You're among the people, and there are many, who were surprised that the U.S. equity market rallied as hard as it did after the election, and furthermore, consolidated those gains. So paint us a picture. How does the future look for U.S. assets? How does the future look for European assets and the underlying macro fundamentals?
Well, I would say the U.S. market is probably the market that is probably the most expensive relative to other markets. This is why earnings season is probably the most important issue for the markets today. The marketplace had higher expectations on quick actions out of our government related to tax reform, infrastructure, And then deregulation. So those are the three things that the marketplace looked for. And that's going to take, obviously, more time. And so if we don't have earnings validating these higher PEs, and we could adjust downward 5 or 10% from here. And if the administration does succeed in some of these items, then the market will then reassert itself going higher.
Lawrence Fink of BlackRock, of course, they're out with earnings today. And really the elephant in the room, David Gura, and, we were speculating yesterday on before Prime Minister May spoke, and we don't like to do that on Bloomberg Surveillance, but you really speculate where active and passive management will be within all the major buy-side shops. You wonder where this will be in 5 years.
Yeah, we've had such an interesting conversation about this over these last few months. BlackRock, of course, investing in a lot of robo-investors, making a move more into that. It's basically interesting to see how that shakes out with the complement of what's happening at Fidelity's, as we've discussed. As well, I should say, Larry Fink, interviewed by Eric Schatzker in Bloomberg Markets Magazine as well. His visage on the cover of that most recent issue of the magazine. A wide-ranging conversation there with Eric Schatzker and our colleagues on Bloomberg Daybreak America, as they talked a bit about the U.S. Political scene as well, and about the company. Of course, we got earnings from BlackRock earlier this morning, and they had a conversation about regulation with Larry Fink, and I thought what was interesting there was he talked about how he didn't necessarily think that the changing the tone of regulations will do much more than easing concerns within, that regulation really hasn't inhibited loaning, and that's an interesting point.
I agree with all this. I think it's great. All I want to know is how Global Wall Street, the people that are our core audience, and we honor and thank you every day that you tune in 5 days a week. I mean, you turn off when Michael Barr's on. I mean, I get that. Michael Barr comes on, Global Wall Street tunes on and goes, okay, what are the Tigers doing today anyways?
And I'd like to thank my wife and my cousin. Good.
We are honored that you all listen to it. I just want to know where the buy side's going to be in 5 years.
Yeah.
If you know, folks, email in or tweet us or, at David Gurr or whatever. We'd like to hear from you, as Eric did with Mr. Fink early in their wonderful interview. I don't know how much more Vanguard-y and everybody else can get.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Just ask you there, I was struck by what Larry Fink had to say about how he's approaching Brexit, the fact that he's having this nonstop conversation with the May administration, but also that he's playing a real waiting game. And I know that every morning at 5 a.m. you're focusing more specifically or more narrowly on Europe and the U.K. Is that something that you hear from the folks you're interviewing, that right now this is a sort of stand pat, wait and see time?
Here's what I would suggest. One word. In America, folks, you'll know it. In the Northeast, certainly, Stamford.
Uh-huh.
That's the one word in the head of every single managing officer of every firm. Is a number of firms went up to Bob Cinch's Stamford, Connecticut, years ago, and it was a great idea until the kids said, "No, I want to be hip and cool like Michael Barr and stay in New York City."
Oh,
I mean,
They
didn't want to go up to Connecticut. That's all there is to it. And they had to move a lot of their intellectual capacity back to Manhattan.
So we're seeing that movement taking place. It's a more vacancy as you're driving down 95.
Larry's got to keep the manpower, as does everyone else. Deutsche Bank with their huge platform in London. UBS right by our present offices in London. Our new offices by Mansion House, the same thing. You got to keep the troops in London because that's where they want to stay, is why you see the waiting, I would say.
Check out that whole interview on the Bloomberg at Bloomberg.com. Eric Schatzker and our colleagues in conversation with Larry Fink, the chairman and CEO of BlackRock.
Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. There's something new from Bloomberg. It's called Lens. Starting right now, you can use the Bloomberg iOS app off your iPhone or iPad or our new Google Chrome extension to read any news story on any website, scan it, and then instantly see the news story's relevant market data from Bloomberg. In addition, see all the bios of the key people mentioned in the story. It's called Lens, and it is just that, a lens into the people and the data of any story you may be reading. Again, Lens brings you the power of Bloomberg's news and data. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension at the Chrome store to try Lens out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/lens. This is well-timed. We usually have the privilege of the former governor of the Federal Reserve System and Columbia economist, Frederick Mishkin. We usually speak to him under the compressing rush of 7 minutes wrapped around something Chair Yellen said. What a joy to speak to Rick Mishkin this morning with a little bit of pace and wind to talk about. We're going to have him for the whole half hour, which is a good and beautiful thing. Rick Mishkin, in your book, your wonderful macroeconomics, policy and practice, is there any discussion of the great distortion and the idea of interest rates at the zero bound and what that means for everyone?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, the issue of the zero lower bound is a very big deal. Something that actually is quite remarkable that we actually never dealt with in terms of monetary economics until very recently, because we just didn't think this would be a real problem. Because the remarkable episode that we're in is one where, in fact, inflation has not been too high, but too low, something that's been really not common at all in the post-war period. So we're now in a brave new world. We're actually in a new normal, and that changes things very dramatically. Clearly, you're not completely happy about having to be in a zero lower bound situation, having interest rates so low. But on the other hand, you may not have a choice. This is just the reality of the way the economy has developed in recent years.
Yeah.
And we're in a situation where it's true that having interest rates near zero does create some strange aspects to the way the economy works. But on the other hand, people will get used to it. And so this is just the way life is sometimes.
Here's the real life, folks. I have Rick Mishkin's textbook on my coffee table in my living room at home. And right near
Well, you really want to bore people.
I do. No. We use it to hold cocktails up. But Rick, it's right near John Hicks' Value and Capital from a few years ago. Can we do traditional modeling in your book and in the great John Hicks books? Can we do that with the interest rate structure we're in right now? I say we can't do ISLM modeling or aggregate supply-demand analysis given the artificial model we're in.
No, I don't agree with you here.
Okay.
What I think is different is the way you think about the conduct of monetary policy. So, and by the way, one thing that's important to say is the U.S. may actually be coming out of this problem, that we're actually in a phase of raising interest rates, that that if the economy does as we hope it will do, that we'll be in a situation where it'll be more normal. Interest rates will be lower than they've been typically, but on the other hand, monetary policy will now be more conventional in terms of what is monetary policy? Changing interest rates. However, when you had a situation where you hit this zero lower bound, and particularly you're in such a low inflation world where inflation is too low, and that you actually need to have what we call real interest rates, that is the interest rate adjusted for inflation, to be actually lower than is normal because the economy is not doing as well as you'd like, then you're in a situation where you may not be able to lower nominal interest rates, the actual interest rate that you hear about when somebody talks about a 5% interest rate, they're talking about a 5% nominal rate. In that situation, what you need to do is you may have to take other steps to pursue expansionary monetary policy. And in fact, this is what we've seen the Federal Reserve do. So, for example, one of the things that we saw happen is the Fed expanded its balance sheet tremendously, not to actually think of changing the balance sheet as so important, expanding the assets of the Federal Reserve, but to actually affect credit markets. So the Fed shifted to buying a lot of long-term treasuries and long-term mortgage-backed securities. What were they trying to do? They couldn't lower the federal funds rate below zero. But by actually buying a lot of longer-term securities, you can actually lower the long-term interest rate on those securities. And importantly, it's longer-term interest rates that are more important to what people do in terms of decisions. Nobody worries about the federal funds rate in terms of what I'm going to do, which is an overnight rate. You worry much more about the rate on your mortgage, which is a very long-term rate, or the mortgage or the interest rate on your car loan, which is intermediate-term rate. So in a sense, what it means is that monetary policy and the ability to affect aggregate demand is still there, but it can't be done with conventional tools. And furthermore, it may be not as effective as using conventional tools. This is one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve is very happy to be raising rates right now.
Professor Mishkin, taking his PhD a few years ago at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Help me here, Rick Mishkin, with the Kool-Aid of Rudy Dornbush, Stan Fisher, and all of MIT, and what it means for a strong dollar policy. Should Chair Yellen worry of a strong dollar?
Well, I think the issue here is if the U.S. economy is doing better than other economies, then in fact the dollar will be strong. That's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah.
So in a sense, the fact that we've had a strong dollar is an indication that the U.S. has actually been done better, and that actually that the Federal Reserve has actually managed it better than many other central banks have managed their situations. The Federal Reserve in the U.S. was much more aggressive in terms of easing policy than, for example, the European Central Bank, and that's one of the reasons that the U.S. has done better. So the strong dollar is actually a reflection of the fact that the U.S. is actually doing pretty reasonably. There is a big issue in the long run that we're not growing as fast as we should. That really doesn't have to do with monetary policy.
Right.
And some of the latest policies in terms of trade that Trump has been pushing probably won't help in that regard.
Is it tougher for the Chinese now because 20 years ago and 30 years ago, there were so many more fixed or quasi-fixed exchange rates, and now we're much more in a floating exchange rate world? Does that disadvantage Chinese policy?
No, I don't think so. I think that what is creating some issues for China is that they're not in the situation they were 20 years ago, which is that they were extremely low-wage country, and in fact that global markets really opened up for them, and that was a huge boon to their economy. Now that we're in a world where, in fact, China is no longer that cheap a place to manufacture goods, that there are other places that have become much cheaper. This is actually, in one sense, a good thing for China because they've gotten so much richer over time, but it's actually much more difficult. And then the second problem is that we're seeing in the world a somewhat of a step back from globalization, a step back from free trade. And we're seeing this, the rise of nationalism in many countries, particularly not just elsewhere, but also in the United States. And all of this means that it is maybe a little bit harder for China to access markets, both because they're not a cheap producer anymore and because markets may not be as open to them. So there is a problem for them, but I think that's where the problem lies.
Rick Mishkin, you welcomed Stan Fisher, the vice chair of the Fed, up to Morningside Heights earlier this week. He delivered a speech at Columbia, and the headline for me was a line. He said, "We appear less likely to face major market disturbances now than we did in the case of the taper tantrum." What did he have to say about the prospects for unwinding the balance sheet and doing that while raising rates?
Well, I think that Stan is absolutely right, and it's also that there are lessons learned from what is frequently called the taper tantrum, which is that the Fed has to do a better job of communication. That the issue of actually having the balance sheet wind down is something that's really a technical issue. It should not be something that should be a major impact on monetary policy. How do you do that? Well, one thing is you give people a lot of advance warning, really explain what you're going to do, start doing it 6 months ahead of time, and then when it happens, it becomes a non-event. So the Fed has clearly moved very much in this direction. And when the taper tantrum occurred several years ago, the big problem there was that the markets interpreted the fact that the Federal Reserve would no longer be buying as much, would taper off its buying of long-term bonds and mortgage-backed securities. They interpreted that as the Fed was going to tighten monetary policy more than it otherwise would. And in fact, this case is very clear that the winding down of the balance sheet, trying to get it down to a much more reasonable level, is not a monetary policy action. It's a technical action, and that it will not actually indicate that the Fed is going to be tighter on monetary policy than it otherwise would. I think the Fed's doing a much better job of communication. They're starting much earlier, and I think this actually will be a non-event.
He talked also just about the role of data in Fed decisions, that the task of moving from information like the dot plot forecasts to a rate decision is, quote, not simple and requires a great deal of analysis and back and forth among FOMC participants at each meeting. What did that tell you about how this Fed is thinking, the process that this Fed is using?
In fact, this is something that actually I've done some research on. About a year ago, I was involved in writing a research paper where we were very critical of Fed's communications about the dot plots and so-called forward guidance in terms of telling people what would happen to the future policy path of the federal funds rate. And our criticism basically was that the Fed was getting into a trap where people were thinking that when they said they were going to be, you know, in their projections said that there were going to be three rate rises over the course of the year, that would mean that that's actually what they would do. What is really key is to make it clear that what you're going to do is going to depend on how the data evolves, so that when you actually talk about projections, they're projections which, in fact, you're almost surely not going to actually have happen. Why? Because the data is not going to be exactly what you expected it to be. And what we've seen is that the Fed has moved away from what we called time-based forward guidance, telling people exact dates, to saying that what's really relevant here is actually how the data evolves. And in fact, what we've seen, for example, the Fed kept on saying that it would raise rates and then did not do so. Why? The economy wasn't as strong as the Fed had hoped. And even more importantly, inflation stayed too low. So I think that the Fed has actually done a much better job in communication. They're what I call now data-based, which is that given what might happen to the data, you might do different things. So, for example, if inflation's still been very tame, if inflation starts to heat up more than we're seeing right now, then the Fed is going to have to be more aggressive at raising rates. Similarly, if the economy gets weaker, that we right now we have a projection that basically the economy is going to be growing solidly, that unemployment's going to stay below 5%, if that changed because something bad happened, then the Fed actually should stop raising rates. So I think that they've been much clearer on this, and I think that's part of what Stan was trying to get across, which is that the Fed's looking at a lot of data, that they're trying to figure out what's going to happen to the economy, and depending on how strong the economy is, how strong inflation is, that's going to change the actual path of the federal funds rate, the future policy path.
Very quickly, we've got about 30 seconds left. Let me ask you about Randy Quarles, reportedly going to be named to head up the Fed's regulatory responsibilities. Private equity guy, his wife's maiden name is on the building. Eccles is her maiden name. What kind of role is he going to play here? What do you think he's going to do in terms of shaping the Fed's direction? Is this the strongest signal yet that we're moving to a more rules-based Fed?
No, I think not. I think that his primary role is going to be on the regulatory front. And clearly that there's an issue that the Trump administration has indicated. They think that the banking regulation has gotten too onerous, and that Quarles has actually indicated that he'd like some moving back from that. So I think that's where his real role is going to be. It is true that he's actually talked about the fact that the Fed should be more rules-based. I think, by the way, what he's saying there is something that I think I do not agree with. And I think that when he starts talking to people inside the Fed, he's going to change his views.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Rick Mishkin, thank you. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member, SIPC.